Topic 1, Invasion of Privacy, Part 3. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, bringing you the third in a series of civil liberties programs dealing with the topic Invasion of Privacy. This is the ninth program produced by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union as a public service. In the first program dealing with invasion of privacy, we heard a lecture by Professor Alan F. Weston, Professor of Public Law at Columbia University, giving an overview on the civil liberties problems involved in wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping and practices in these fields across the country. In the second program on invasion of privacy, we heard a discussion by Dr. David K. Berninghausen, director of the University Library School at the University of Minnesota, on the literature in the field of invasion of privacy. In this connection, the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union has printed a bibliography of literature available in this topic, and anyone interested in receiving a copy may send their name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Joining Dr. Berninghausen was Professor Ellingston, a criminologist on the faculty of the University of Minnesota Law School, discussing invasion of privacy by our social and welfare agencies. In this program, we will hear a lecture by Dr. Paul Murphy of the History Department of the University of Minnesota on a historical view of invasion of privacy, and Dr. E.G. Williamson, Dean of Students of the University of Minnesota, who will discuss privacy in students' records at the university. In the fourth and last in this series, we will have a discussion with State Senator Wayne G. Popham of Minneapolis and Public Defender C. Paul Jones on wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping in Minnesota. And now, Dr. Paul Murphy on the history of invasion of privacy.
Asking a historian to give a history of privacy as an aspect of civil liberties is somewhat the same as asking a medical historian to give a history of the left arm. It is not a subject which has a disembodied history in and of itself, but has been a part of the general history of man's quest for independence and for individuality since the beginning of time. Further, in my probings to try and find background material which would relate to this problem, I was bothered by the fact that the lawyers aren't too much help. The usual legal book, even the ones that Mr. Berninghausen talks about this morning, usually begin with one paragraph which says, privacy has always been a very historic and fundamental concept. Now let's look at the modern situation. One of these lawyers did, however, suggest that probably it had its origins with Adam and Eve in the garden, as far as the two were concerned seeking privacy through the fig leaf, but he does not develop this into modern legal precedent. I suppose we start really with a fundamental concept of Western law and of the English common law, which goes back to Bracton, and which is, of course, that the king is under God and law, which was translated by Cook later into the general tradition which we hold so dear, that we are a part of a government of laws and not of men. This does infer then that our legal guarantees are sacred and that the individual who sets himself above the law or attempts to try to say that he will adjust the law to the needs of society very frequently tends to rub us the wrong way. Certainly in the development of English common law guarantees, this was the case. If Cook's greatness was testified to by any single thing, it was his ability in defying the king to at the same time guarantee individual freedom. It was Cook, for example, who was responsible for developing a fairly fundamental guarantee in what we call the right of self, a right against self-incrimination. Again, in standing up to the King's Star Chamber, which had developed the rather traditional pattern of arresting political dissidents on a trumped-up charge of larceny or burglary, getting them before a court, and then saying, "What do you think of the crown?" and then in turn reconvicting them for treason because of the remark they were forced to make, Cook said, no, this invades a man's privacy, and it is a law which, again, must be guaranteed against all rulers, royal or otherwise. And from Cook, again, we get a very famous and ultimately basic statement to this principle, as he wrote in the third of his very famous institutes, a man's home is his castle. The house of everyone is to him as his castle and fortress, as well for his defense against injury and as violence as for his repose. Certainly this comes to us in American history, in our own practical early experience. If there was anything the founding fathers objected to most, really, before the fatal days of the midnight ride of Paul Revere, it was the practice of the British to use so-called writs of assistance, blanket search warrants, which could be attained from any judge and passed to any other official who was around, which enabled any Britisher to search any American home at his discretion. It was out of this particular hated practice that Americans insisted upon and got an amendment to our Constitution, the famous number 4, which guarantees us against, of course, unreasonable search and seizure. But again, the problem of privacy does raise, as again Mr. Berninghausen so nicely suggested, serious questions of balancing individual liberties against the needs of society. Once again, I again call your attention to the very obvious but often overlooked term in the Fourth Amendment, which guarantees against unreasonable search and seizure, which does suggest that there are certain needs of society which may warrant, from time to time, certain types of invasion. Yet these must be precise, and Americans have insisted that they be precise from that time really on until the present day. In developing then a body of law in this country which might be called a law of privacy, we largely stuck to English antecedents and didn't create anything which was individual in this area for a good long time. And again, looking through the records, I come across two quotations, really, from the 19th century, which involve privacy. The one is by Justice Field of the Supreme Court, written in the 1880s, which is an eloquent statement, I believe. He says, of all the rights of the citizen, few are of greater importance or more essential to his peace and happiness than the right of personal security. And that involves not merely protection of his person from assault, but exemption of his private affairs, books, and papers from the inspection and scrutiny of others. Without the enjoyment of this right, all others would lose half their virtue. Or Justice Harlan, who wrote at the same time, the principle that embodies the essence of constitutional liberty and security forbids all invasions on the part of the government and its employees of the sanctity of a man's home and the privacies of his life. These are lovely statements. The only problem is the context in which they were made. Both Justice Field and Justice Harlan were intimately tied with large corporations in their day. Both of these cases involved situations in which the books of large corporations had been subpoenaed for investigation of highly irregular activities in terms of watering stock and rebates and so forth and so forth. The one case involved the Southern Pacific Railroad, of which Field was a principal stockholder. And the suggestion that there was a basic right of the individual here is rather clouded, I think, in the process. So that the real tradition, then, of American background comes, again, largely from English antecedent. And here, three old cases, I think, show you some of the problems that came up. Prior to 1890, as Mr. Berninghausen has again pointed out, and as I'd like to develop, the word privacy did not have legal meaning as such. This is a term which has only developed a positive legal definition in the years since 1890. The English still do not have this as a part of their legal jargon. The concept as it exists in England exists in other branches of the law, but not independently and separately. But again, there were branches of the law which lent itself to this development. And I suppose if there are any four components of the whole development of privacy, it was such ancient concepts as property rights, on one hand, the law of trespass, the law of defamation, and the law generally of personal injury. Again, three English cases, I think, are revealing in how thinking evolved on this question. The first involved the old famous poet, Alexander Pope, and grew out of a situation in which a gentleman named Curl, a bookseller, managed to get hold of certain of Pope's letters, and also those of Jonathan Swift, and he published them without Mr. Pope's or Mr. Swift's consent. Pope sued, as well he might have, not, however, on the grounds that his privacy had been invaded, but on the theory that his property had been stolen. And the court, in upholding Mr. Pope in this particular situation, inferred that there was a right of property which involved individuality and individual personal affairs, which went a bit beyond just stealing a man's horse or his cow or his tangible property in the process. A second precedent, which again shows, I think, a nice evolution, was a case in 1820. A young pharmacist had gone to work for a senior pharmacist, but in the process of watching the master fill prescriptions and filling out instructions for the taking of these pills, he made mental notes of exactly the formulas being used, as well as copying in after hours some of the instructions which the master handed out. Eventually, he left the employ of his master, and shortly thereafter set up his own business, wherein he began making prescriptions by the same formulae and handing out the same instructions which he had carefully copied from the master. Once again, suit followed, but here the theft which was charged was obviously not the theft of anything tangible, even of letters, but the theft actually then of ideas. And the court went on to suggest that property could include, as well as tangible property, a man's ideas, a man's reputation, a man's name in the same context. The third case which Americans were intrigued with was a case involving Queen Victoria and her consort Prince Albert. It seemed that the Queen and the Prince were fond of etchings, and one of their private pastimes was collecting these, which they enjoyed greatly. But one enterprising gentleman managed to learn of this, and gaining access some way to the palace, succeeded in at least getting the names of these and publishing a catalog of them, which the public promptly bought in large numbers. Again, the prince filed suit, claiming once again that his property rights had been violated, but the court again waived property, since again nothing was tangible, added that property could include a great many things and that the rights of the individual could be handled in a variety of ways. It was this, then, I think, that set the stage eventually for Americans to take the next step, which was essential in this process. And the hero of the story, if you like it in historical terms, was a Boston lawyer whose name was Samuel Warren. It seemed that Samuel Warren had married a lady named Mabel Bayard, who was the daughter of the then senator of Massachusetts. And they had set up housekeeping in Boston in the Back Bay area. They were wealthy. They entertained lavishly, days of the great barbecue in American history. But this was also a day of emerging expose journalism. It was a day of emerging reporters. It was a day of emerging cameras, and already we begin to get some of these devices coming into the picture. The reporters, particularly for a journal in Boston known as the Saturday Evening Gazette, which was a journal which specialized in blue blood items, sent their reporters around constantly to peer through the windows of the Warren House, to take pictures of the lady as she left in her finery, even to watch the servants bringing groceries in from the grocery store so that they could report what was going on. And Mr. Warren, who was an attorney, decided that this had gone much too far. He sat down one day with his law partner, a young Harvard law graduate named Louis D. Brandeis, and the two decided that it was time to consider the possibility of a separate right of privacy, a law of privacy, in American terms. The article which they produced, which was published in the Harvard Law Review in December of 1890, has been more or less the fountain of all law on privacy from that time until the present. Once again, the rationale of the article, I think, is very intriguing. Brandeis, once again, is not a great deal of help as far as his own historical background is concerned. He says, privacy is an old tradition which goes way back in common law, but again, let's look at the modern problem. So I'm up against my usual difficulties. But more importantly, he said, that it is high time that we put together, out of the various elements and branches of English law, something which peculiarly fits the new circumstances arising especially out of the development of new devices in America. He says the old common law categories, once again, of property and defamation are no longer really highly pertinent. And again, for American needs in an industrial society, something new generally is warranted. The article then very quickly caused a great splash within the legal world. Lawyers began citing it very early, and it was used actually, although unsuccessfully, in two cases in the early 1890s. The first major case in which it actually was used for a basic argument in a case was that of Abigail, which Mr. Berninghausen mentions. And again, the New York court refused basically to accept the idea that privacy was in and of itself a separate concept. But the New York legislature was not willing, and the subsequent statute, which in effect overruled the decision, was a landmark step in this regard. Georgia went even farther in 1903 in a case which was basically the same type of case, went on to uphold the idea that there was a distinct law of privacy which was definable in court and in modern American legal terms. Since that time, the concept of privacy as a legal definition has developed so that at the present time, 29 states of the United States recognize this concept as a legally definable concept. It is indirectly recognized in four others. Minnesota is one of these four, at least to the extent that the courts have refrained from holding that it does not exist, even though in certain cases involving privacy, they have tended to turn them off onto questions of defamation or property or private rights. As the law then has evolved since 1903, we now have roughly 300 and some odd cases on the statute books, or I should say on the law books, involving the definition of privacy. And in legal terms, the categories which are normally included are these. First, intrusion upon a plaintiff's seclusion or solitude. This has produced a body of definable law. Secondly, public disclosure of embarrassing facts about the plaintiff. The very sort of thing that Brandeis and Warren were concerned about. Again, a body of law has evolved. Thirdly, publicity which places the plaintiff in a false light in the public eye. And again, legal precedents here. And finally, appropriation for the defendant's advantage of the plaintiff's name or his likeness for use in public. Consequently, at the present time, we have in workable, primarily private law, a great body of privacy precedents which can be applied and frequently are applied in defining this concept in modern terms. Once again, however, I would like to return to a basic point about which I feel very strongly. No matter how much legal precedent we have, no matter how many decisions are on the statute books, a great portion of the effectiveness of privacy protections and guarantees depends upon the climate of opinion, once again, of the era. A great many of these statutes were on the books, a great many of these precedents were on the books in the First World War. Yet we suddenly found in the First World War that government officials took the law into themselves, that the Attorney General of the United States more or less condoned a great variety of forms of private investigation. It was the great patriotic thing in World War I to become a member of the American Protective League, which was a sort of an unofficial body, but still authorized and sanctioned by the Justice Department. This gave you a nice shiny badge and enabled you to go around and probe into your neighbor's business and then turn the information over to the federal government. Sort of the equivalent of air raid wardens in World War II, except in far more vicious terms. But once again, with the government condoning this type of activity, again, the law very frequently tends to fold in the process. I've always been interested in the organizations which were condoned, either formally or informally, in the First World War, because their very titles are so revealing of what happened. There was the American Defense Society, the National Security League, the American Rights League, the Knights of Liberty, the Anti-Allied Anti-German League, the Anti-Yellow Dog League, the American Anti-Anarchy Society, the Boy Spies of America, the Sedition Slammers, and the Terrible Threateners, all more or less authorized to engage in private operations. The American Civil Liberties Union was born in this same era, and certainly a good portion of its birth pains came out of alarm by a good many decent citizens about just this kind of behavior, just this kind of abrogation of individual liberties. The union initially was actually far more concerned with a variety of substantive rights and the violation of free speech, freedom of press during the war, but certainly also took great concern with procedural rights, of which, of course, privacy matters are primarily concerned. And during the 20s, again, the union maintained an alert watch over the activities of a great many people, but at the same time, individuals very often tended to twist the law in their own fashion. In this regard, maybe I make one other point before stopping. The early and most famous leading case in connection with the whole business of wiretapping was the famous Ole Olmsted case of the late 1920s. It involved rum runners on Puget Sound. It involved also the question of the federal government tapping the wires of the particular concern and eventually convicting on the grounds of wiretap evidence. The Supreme Court that heard the decision heard it in a period of conservatism. It heard it with Chief Justice William Howard Taft writing the leading opinion. It heard it in a period, again, when property rights seemed so much more important than private ones. Taft could see nothing wrong at all with wiretapping of this kind. He said it doesn't invade personally and directly an individual's rights. Nothing was broken into here. No records were bodily taken. And he said also, quotes, a standard which would forbid the reception of evidence if obtained by other than nice ethical conduct by government officials would make society suffer and give criminals greater immunity than has been known hitherto. And I'm alarmed to have to report, as probably you've already beaten me to the punch, that if you change about five words in that statement, it could have been the same thing Mr. Goldwater said in his St. Petersburg address about 2 months ago. On the other hand, Mr. Brandeis was strong. He said, if the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. And Justice Holmes was even more direct. Wiretapping is dirty business. It boils down really then to the fact that the effectiveness of any guarantees do depend upon the leadership we have and the willingness of the leadership to abide by them. At the same time, the laws themselves can certainly actively affect such a process. And if we really are to maintain a tradition which respects, I think, the individual and individual liberty, the balance, again, is essential to our way of life. Thank you.
That was Dr. Paul Murphy of the History Department of the University of Minnesota discussing the historical view of civil liberties implications of invasion of privacy. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. At the panel discussion at which Dr. Murphy made his presentation, Dr. E.G. Williamson, Dean of Students of the University of Minnesota, discussed invasion of privacy and students' records at the university. We present now in this program Dr. Williamson's discussion of invasion of privacy of student records.
I will not restrict my remarks to release of data from the Counseling Bureau, but will rather speak about several other university departments. Our university follows usually the practices enforced in other universities with regard to the release of information about students. Let me first identify a number of the types of data which a university naturally collects and which may or may not be released. Of course, there are expressed viewpoints on sensitive issues and opinions in the classes. There are lists of membership in various kinds of student organizations. There are disciplinary records. There are, of course, the grade records. And finally, there are faculty evaluations of the competence of individuals for certain professional types of work. The university is highly decentralized. There is no adopted policy governing the release of information, to my knowledge, officially by any of the agencies, either central or in the separate colleges. Professors are free to release whatever they wish to release, and they would properly make their own decisions. There are no officially adopted policies with respect to the release of information binding upon university departments other than the academic departments. We are in the process of trying to formulate such a policy with regard to my own office, but we have not yet adopted any, although we have some practices. In general, I would say that the various components of the university use these criteria with respect to the release of information known about students, although there is no uniformity. But the generally observed practice, I think, would yield this kind of a summarization. What uses are to be made of the information is an important factor. I had recently an inquiry from an official of another university about the evaluation of a student's deportment behavior, a student who had been dropped from this university for disciplinary reasons by an official agency of the university. It seemed to me that the uses to be made of the information justified a very frank disclosure of the basis for the disciplinary action on this student. This was an inquiry from a sister institution, and as an official, I felt that I would have been derelict in my obligations to the other institution if I did not give a frank disclosure. I do not know what action was taken. It was none of my business. An inquiry from a potential employer would seem to be in the best interest of the students to give a very frank appraisal, insofar as the inquirer was to use the information in making a determination of eligibility for appointment. So the uses to be made of the information would seem to be an important criterion. The second criterion that is generally followed, as far as I can observe in the various parts of the university, who inquires? Who inquires? Does the individual have any entitlement to the information he's asking for? A third criterion has to do with the age of the data. Shortly after I became Dean of Students in 1941, I received a frantic letter from a member of the military forces stationed in India. It seemed that he wanted to enter military school, officer school, but on his university record, in indelible ink, was the action of being dropped for disciplinary reasons. He didn't want to turn in this grade record for this purpose with such a notation. I erased the action because it seemed to me that after 20 years, the data was not relevant to the particular use to be made of it. Some disciplinary records should be forgotten after a given amount of time in terms of known fact that the college adolescent age is often an age of exploration and sometimes deviation from standards and norms. So the age of the data certainly is an important criterion in the release. The fourth criterion has to do with evaluation of the data as contrasted with the facts. Sometimes facts can be misinterpreted. Sometimes we get inquiries as to interpretation, sometimes as to fact. And it seems to me the one who makes the release has to judge whether the facts are relevant today and whether they are to be forgotten. Now, as I say, these general types of data and the criteria are decentralized in our university, as is true of most universities. And the practices vary somewhat with regard to the release of medical records, for example, as contrasted with the release of grades, evaluations of competence, and with regard to behavior. There is no single universal answer to the question of what should be released. It is a very complicated question, and one that is better left to the discretion and good judgment of individual offices and of individual members of the staff and faculty. For the most part, a university is dedicated to helping its students to mature and to develop competence. And we are not in the business of over-evaluating data about the student. We're in the business of helping him. So we're disposed to do those things which are in his best interest. But we do have some obligations to other agencies of the state and of the nation. We do have some obligation in the loyalty investigations, and we do answer direct questions about it. I've never been willing to permit any intelligence agency of the federal government to look at the record. I am willing to answer questions directly put about a given individual, but I do not think our records are open for inspection by the agency making the investigation. But on the other hand, I think we do have an obligation to release information of fact and even of interpretation as to loyalty about our individual students. But as I say, the university is highly decentralized, and each agency, each office, each member of the staff really makes his own policy at the present time, governed by the general considerations that I spoke about with respect to our being a public agency with obligations to other agencies as well as obligations to the individual student.
That was Dr. E.G. Williamson, Dean of Students of the University of Minnesota, speaking on invasion of privacy and students' records. Following this discussion, there were questions from the audience, and Dean Williamson was asked, "What about the availability of records to the parent and child?" Dr. Williamson answered.
Well, I think I should like to explain that my own professional life has been devoted entirely to aiding the college adolescent to strive for some measure of maturity. And with that as a background, I would say that everything in the record should be available to the student himself. I can't see any ethical or educative basis for withholding of information that the institution has about every individual, including appraisals and evaluations of his motives and his mental health, his political affiliations and ideas and so forth. So I think the full record should be made available to the individual in a counseling relationship, because as we have evolved counseling within the educational institution, it is a kind of a personalized aiding of the individual to strive for maturity. Therefore, knowledge of right conduct, knowledge of self and one's potential is certainly essential to the educated, to this kind of educative objective. Now, with regard to the parents, I think this is another issue, not as easily resolved. Because in the case of the college-age student, many times he is in the process of disestablishing a dependency relationship with his parents. We meet this situation head on many times when the parent, as a taxpayer, demands the full information. And we have to say that, but look, we are trying to mediate between you and your children. And many times we are a substitute parent. Therefore, we cannot reveal to you the full record of what your child has said to us about you and your relationship. This is difficult to get acceptance, obviously. particularly if it happens to be a regent parent. Or a president parent. Or a faculty parent. And these actually happen. Nevertheless, we do have to screen and sift the information that we have about the child, keeping in mind that we too have some obligation to the parent, but it's an interpretive obligation, we feel. I'm speaking now from a counseling background. We cannot reveal all of the information sometimes without interpreting it in such a way as that the individual parent feels that we are carrying out an effective and useful substitute parent function. That's the only way I can answer.
Dr. Williamson was then asked, will the university also tell the student what the university has told government agencies or prospective employers who have asked for information about students? Dr. Williamson answered,
well, remember I said that the university, as is true of all universities, operates in a very much of a decentralized manner. And I can't speak for the university. I only work there. As far as I'm concerned, I would report to a student my own assessment of him in terms of competence, stability, and the like, and what I had reported to anyone else. Because as a counselor, I feel that he's entitled to this information. I don't know whether or not other people in the university would take such a position, but I certainly would feel that way. In fact, I would feel that I was destroying my effectiveness as a counselor if I wasn't frank with him and gave him the full information, even though my assessment was unfavorable to him.
That was Dr. E.G. Williamson, Dean of Students at the University of Minnesota, speaking on the right of privacy in students' records. This is Lynn Kastner, Executive Director of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union. Preceding Dr. Williamson this evening was Dr. Paul Murphy of the University History Department speaking of invasion of privacy from a historical viewpoint. Dr. David K. Berninghausen, Director of the Library School, who has spoken on the literature in invasion of privacy on last week's program, prepared a bibliography on the right to privacy. This bibliography has been reproduced by the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union and is available to anyone who wishes to send for it without cost. If you would like the bibliography on literature in Invasion of Privacy, send your name and address to Minnesota Civil Liberties Union, 925 Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Among the literature Dr. Berninghausen discusses is The Loyalty of Free Men by Alan Barth, a book dealing with the operation of loyalty programs in the United States government, a discussion of the effect of such programs on scientific research and on the academic community as well. Besides discussing the actual workings of such programs, Barth also gives a fresh and persuasive presentation of basic arguments for the determined maintenance of freedom of thought and speech. Also by Alan Barth is The Price of Liberty. In that work, Barth discusses current abuses in detection and punishment of crime. His main thesis, that liberty is being imperiled for the sake of order, is documented by many cases dealing with the violation of civil liberties, wiretapping, electronics eavesdropping, illegal seizure of evidence, and other invasions of our privacy. Dr. Berninghausen discusses Myron Brenton's The Privacy Invaders. That book is a discussion of methods used by employers, corporations, credit investigators, private investigators, and others who obtain personal information about individuals. The discussions of how such information is gathered, bought, and sold to a number of growing private inquirers is documented by many specific examples. Also discussed is Ralph S. Brown's Loyalty and Security, Employment Tests in the United States. This book is a detailed analysis of recent trends in loyalty and security qualifications for both job seekers and job holders, prepared by a member of the Yale Law School faculty. Initially, Professor Brown examines prevailing loyalty tests for federal, state, and local public servants, as well as similar requirements for labor union members and others privately employed. Subsequently, he explores the Russian communist threat to national security and finally discusses the rationale and administration of loyalty programs. The author recommends that security programs for federal employees, government contractors, and military personnel be limited only to the most sensitive areas, that most state and local programs should be eliminated. He discusses The Eavesdroppers by Samuel, Dash, and other authors. This study was sponsored by the Fund for the Republic and exposes the subsurface system of electronic surveillance of communication. The three authors, two lawyers, and one electronics engineer, have written the book in three parts. Part one dealing with the status of eavesdroppers, part two describing the electronic techniques used, and part three reviewing the legal position of such devices. The book alerts the public to the widespread use of electronic surveillance by law officers, business firms, and private detectives. Other books discussed by Dr. Berninghausen is Privacy, The Right to Be Let Alone by Ernst & Morris, The Brain Watchers by Martin Gross, The Naked Society by Vance Packard, The Test of Freedom by Norman Thomas, The Constitution and Loyalty Programs by Professor Weston, who spoke on our first program, and other books and articles. If you would like a copy of this bibliography, send your name and address to MCLU, Upper Midwest Building, Minneapolis, Minnesota. The next program on Invasion of Privacy, the fourth in this series, will be a discussion with C. Paul Jones, State Public Defender for the State of Minnesota, and Senator Wayne G. Popham, who introduced a bill in the last legislature dealing with wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping. This discussion will focus on the problems of wiretapping and electronics eavesdropping in Minnesota. This has been an educational production of the Minnesota Civil Liberties Union.